From NPR and WBUR, I'm Elise Hu.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and more than 200 people are still missing in Northern California as the campfire continues to burn in the woods of Butte County north of Sacramento. At least 42 people have died in the fire, making it the deadliest in the state's history. Thousands of buildings burned in and around the town of Paradise, now pretty much Paradise Lost. More than 50,000 people have been forced to evacuate, and President Trump approved a request yesterday for a major disaster declaration for the entire state. NPR correspondent Eric Westervelt is in Chico, just neighboring the fire. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Robin.
Oh, thanks so much for being there for us. We've been hearing your work. It's just quite something what you're telling us. And we've seen the videos, you know, people praying as they tried to flee the fire, abandoned cars, so much smoke. It's hit the Bay Area, 150 miles south. But what's it like up close?
Yeah, Robin, I mean, surreal is a word that sometimes gets abused, but I think in this instance it's fitting. I mean, there's this sort of eerie darkness at noon with a hint of glowing orange in the sky across Chico and the greater fire zone here. You know, the smoke's sort of blotting out part of the sun. The air quality's bad. There's some ash, you know, on the ground. Most people are walking around wearing these small masks, the kind you might wear if you're, you know, painting your living room or something. And closer to the fire, it's you know, far worse. I was up in Paradise, and there are still these smoldering piles around. Firefighters were going sort of, you know, pile to pile, checking on potential hot spots and flare-ups. And they were finding them, putting them out. You know, and there's just so few remaining structures there that that didn't catch fire, but it really is a surreal kind of atmosphere.
Look, I've mentioned before, but my brother lost his house in the fires that are down south outside Malibu, and I'm pretty sure he's in shock. That's how it feels. And it wasn't even a family home, you know, a place that people had lived in for, you know, 30, 40 years. What are you, I mean, what's striking you about the people you're meeting?
Well, I'd say, you know, kind of like your brother, I mean, people are stunned. It's difficult. It's hard. They're tired, but they're also resilient. I mean, there's a kind of a let's pull together and get through this ethos, Robin. I mean, there's also intense emotion. I mean, the people are exhausted. They're drained. They haven't slept a lot. They're crashing with family or friends or in shelters. You know, I spoke to one woman at a donation center here in Chico, you know, who wanted to talk to me, but said, I'm just not sure I'll, you know, make it through this interview without breaking down. And sure enough, you know, she couldn't. The tears came pretty quick because people, you know, as you mentioned, they've lost everything. You know, they're waiting to hear about loved ones. They're hoping that, you know, word of their brother or uncle or aunt, friends, you know, missing or are in fact at a shelter with friends. But, you know, as more time passes, their worry and fear is just growing.
Oh, that, I mean, 200 missing. That's astonishing. Look, what kind of support are, you mentioned a shelter. What kind of support are the evacuees getting?
Well, Red Cross and Salvation Army, Robin, are here and in force, you know, staying busy with food, shelter, and other help. There are several donation centers around town, and I was struck they're really just overflowing with new and used clothes, blankets, shoes, pillows, and, you know, games and books for children and more. People are giving all they can up here. And, you know, even, Robin, some people who lost their homes in Paradise were volunteering to sort and organize these donations, you know, the displaced helping the displaced. It was kind of incredible. At one point, you know, there was a big round of applause that went up when someone said, hey, you know, and community members coming with, you know, hot lunch for 200 people, and everyone cheered. And, you know, I talked to this one evacuee, Jimmy Coter. He lived in Paradise, worked at a local hardware store, and like so many, Robin, you know, he had to flee fast with little more than the clothes he had on his back. And he said the outpouring up here has really helped sort of pick up his spirits.
The outreach that's been going on, just the amount of volunteer help, and just being able to see people that you know on a daily basis that you haven't seen in four days, you know. I mean, it brings a tear to your eye, you know. And just the way people have been so kind and generous and helpful.
Well, and that, I mean, it's great to hear. But they still have whatever is ahead. And I'm thinking swaths of this region were, you know, decimated by fires in the last fire season, and they haven't recovered. And Northern California has a housing crisis. So what are they going to do?
Well, it's difficult. People are still in a bit of shock. You know, I asked one older woman, a lot of older folks, you know, wanted to settle in Paradise to live here, live out their retirement years. And I said, are you going to rebuild? And she just said, I'm just trying to get through the day. I'm just trying to make it. I'm thinking about my meal and getting, you know, she wanted to get clothes for church. She didn't have much clothes. And thinking about rebuilding, that was just a conversation to have down the road.
Way down the road, when they find the road. NPR's Eric Westervelt in Chico, California. Eric, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
We're still assessing the impact of the midterms. One casualty of the elections, the Republicans in the bipartisan House Climate Solutions Caucus. The caucus requires an equal number of GOP and Democratic members, and last week's election wiped out nearly half of its Republicans. Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo of Florida co-founded the group in 2016 with Florida Democrat Ted Deutch. Critics say it hasn't done much, but was a rare show on the Hill of bipartisanship around climate change. Curbelo, he's now out after losing his reelection. So what does this mean for the caucus and bipartisan efforts to fight climate change? Zoya Tierstein is a reporter at the environmental news outlet Grist. She joins us from Seattle. Zoya, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you first tell us a little more about the group, how big it is now, and its achievements?
Yeah, so the Climate Solutions Caucus is sort of like the Noah's Ark of congressional caucuses. So there has to be one Democrat for every Republican. And that's pretty much the only rule. If you have a history of climate skepticism, you can join. So that's pretty much the only rule. And it's been around since early 2016. And now it has 90 members, but that was before the midterms. As you said, it lost about 47% of its Republican mass.
So originally when these Florida congressmen created it, what was the objective? What was the point of the caucus?
The point was to educate members on the Hill and to explore economic solutions to climate change. So basically they'd go around and talk to different members and try and get them on board.
And how well did they do?
Really well. They grew, you know, they doubled their size in a year. And there's a long line of Democrats waiting to join, and they haven't been able to join yet because there's not enough Republicans. But it's been popular.
Zoya, talk a little bit about what this caucus has been able to achieve in its last couple of years of existence.
Well, that's sort of the problem. It hasn't accomplished much. It had one sort of success that we can count, and that was a little over a year ago when almost all of the GOP members of the caucus voted to defeat an amendment that would have prevented the Department of Defense from addressing climate change. And that's pretty much it.
You've reported on how a number of Republicans in the group itself had been skeptical in various ways about climate change. One of those Republicans was Peter Roskam, who just lost his reelection bid in Illinois. He called climate change, quote, junk science in the past. So is anything really lost by these Republicans no longer being in the caucus?
Well, that's a good question. There is something to be said for having moderates on board in Congress talking about and thinking about climate change. That can't be understated. Then again, the group had sort of this test of its abilities about it this past summer when Majority Whip Steve Scalise introduced a bill that basically condemned the idea of a carbon tax. And a lot of the Solutions Caucus members voted for it. And that was sort of a test of the caucus's abilities. Could they vote against this bill that was basically just condemning the very idea of a carbon tax? And by the way, a carbon tax is pretty much agreed upon as a top conservative solution to climate change, a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And they couldn't do it. Only four of them voted against it, of the Republican members of the caucus.
So what did that tell you?
That they weren't serious about tackling climate change.
So going forward, then, these Republicans who lost, who are being replaced by Democrats who do take climate issues more seriously, even if the House does take action, are there signs of more robust action on climate change from the Senate that are possible? Are there areas of alignment across the aisle for possible solutions?
You know, the Senate is probably not the best place for climate change solutions right now, and it probably won't be for some time. In the meantime, the House is now blue, so that is heartening for in terms of climate change solutions. There might be some proposed legislation. We don't know if it'll pass because, you know, they have to have the Senate on board as well. But what I can say is that voters made it clear, in some respect at least, that people who have these shady records on climate aren't going to fly. So it's not, I mean, if you call climate change junk science and then run against someone with a really strong climate platform like Sean Casten, voters are going to see right through that.
What role will the House Climate Caucus play in the next Congress then, or what role should it play?
Yeah, it's hard to say. The director of the Climate Caucus says that it will continue. And there is a line still of Democrats waiting to join. What they say, because there's this one rule about there being one Republican and one Democrat, mm-hmm. what they're going to do is they're not going to make any Democrats leave the caucus. They're going to wait and see if they can get enough Republicans to join up to even out the numbers again, and then start recruiting more Republicans after that again. So it might continue. I mean, it lost 47% of its Republicans, so that's a big hit. It's hard to say whether it'll continue in the same capacity that it used to.
All right. Uncertainty about the House Climate Solutions Caucus. Zoya Tierstein is a reporter at grist.org speaking with us about that caucus, which lost nearly half of its Republican members in last week's election. Zoya, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump's new plan to prohibit migrants from seeking asylum in the U.S. if they cross the border outside of the designated entry points is likely to face legal challenges. But our next guest says even if it's found to be legal, it's not practical, and she has a plan that is. Sonia Nazario is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist who's actually journeyed with migrating families. She's best known for Enrique's Journey, her L.A. Times series and book following a Honduran boy's struggle to find his mother in the U.S., as he rode atop trains making their way north. She outlined her plan in a recent New York Times op-ed, warning that parts of it will annoy both liberals and conservatives. And she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. I have the emails from both sides to prove it. Both are annoyed with me. Yes.
Right, because you laid this out in an op-ed for the New York Times. And before we get to that, we want to just roll back. Many people are very familiar with your story and your phenomenal book, Enrique's Journey. But you yourself are an immigrant. Your father fled Syria because of persecution of Christians there. Your mother fled Poland to escape the oncoming persecution of the Jewish populations. They ended up in Argentina.
Yes, and her family members who stayed in Poland were gassed in Auschwitz.
Yeah, so you are familiar with the urgency
migration. And then we migrated from Argentina to the United States, fleeing control of the universities where my father worked by the military in the 50s. I have a lot of experience in my family with fleeing persecution.
Right, and you say right off the bat, you put this in context, which is that the flow of migrants into the U.S. is, first of all, a quarter of what it was at its height in 2000. And it's not Mexicans with all the pejoratives that many have been using. The majority of them are fleeing violence.
It has radically changed over the last 20 years that I've looked at this. I think actually when I go speak in Alabama and North Carolina and places where people have their hair on fire on this issue, they're reacting to what was happening in the 1990s and the early 2000s when we were seeing 1.6 million people being apprehended at our border every year by Border Patrol. But today it's a quarter of that. Before, it was largely single Mexican men. They were economic migrants. And today, 53% are coming from three of the most violent countries on earth, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. So it's a fundamental shift in who's coming and why they're coming.
They're hearing the rhetoric from President Trump. They know what's going on here, and still they come because it's a choice for many of them, you say, between coming and death.
Right. What I have seen in these neighborhoods in Honduras is that 9, 10, and 11-year-old boys are forcibly conscripted to join gangs. Join or we kill you. Girls who are pretty in neighborhoods are told you're going to be the gang leader's girlfriend or we will exterminate your whole family. Business owners are told you must pay the war tax to the gang. The war tax goes up every month. You reach a point where you can't pay it, and they say you pay or you are dead in 24 hours. And the flaw in the president's strategy is that if you're facing someone threatening to kill you in the next 24 hours, you don't think about what you're going to face a month and a half from now, 1,600 miles away at the U.S.-Mexico border. You're thinking about getting out of Dodge and staying alive.
Okay, so you say, here's my proposal. First, address that violence and despair that's pushing migrants out of these three countries. And you point out there are already global organizations that are trying to do that. But the Trump administration isn't supporting them.
There are two groups, one in Honduras, one in Guatemala, that are supported by the UN, by the Organization of American States, that are trying to attack corruption. And they have basically been emasculated by their presidents in the last year or so because they are attacking corruption at the highest levels, including by the presidents of those countries. And the U.S. in the past has strongly supported these organizations, but President Trump has not stood up and said, we will not allow this to happen. We want these organizations to continue to look at this corruption and address this corruption. The president has threatened to cut off aid to governments that don't stop the caravan, as if they could stop these, you know, thousands of people marching north. It's that very aid in 2014, when we saw a spike in children coming to the United States alone from these countries. The Congress wisely more than doubled foreign aid to these three countries to try to address the root causes. And we funded these violence prevention programs. And I went in 2016 to the most violent neighborhood in the murder capital of the world for 4 years in a row, San Pedro Sula, Honduras. We funded outreach centers in that neighborhood where kids could get off the streets and get help getting jobs. We went after the killers in these horrible neighborhoods where in Honduras, 96% of homicides, you can get away with it because no one's going to step forward as a witness. Tomorrow, the gang leaves you dead in the middle of the street. But we worked with witnesses, and 2 or 3 months into building trust, they say, can you testify against this murderer? And they cover you in a black burqa. They put you in a little closet with wheels on it. And under the black burqa, in the little closet with wheels on it, with the one-way mirror, they shove you into the courtroom, and through a voice distorter, you testify. And now more than half of homicides in these horrible neighborhoods are getting guilty verdicts. So in this terrible place, we saw a 62% drop in homicides, cut in half the number of children fleeing north to the United States.
Let's get you to repeat this. This is again in 2014. We saw the huge surge of children coming to the border.
Unaccompanied immigrant minors. Right.
That were escaping this violence you've just described. But after just 2 years, and by the way, the nonprofit that the U.S. helped was the Association for a More Just Society, helping to investigate these murders, getting people into burqas to testify. Incredible. Murders plummeted by 62% over 2 years, and the number of children showing up was cut in half.
That's right. It works. Those pilot programs in Honduras cost $100 million a year, which sounds like a lot of money until you look at what we're spending on migrants when they arrive at our border. We're spending $1.2 billion just for detention shelters to hold immigrant children when they arrive at our border.
Okay, this is the part of your plan that many, especially fiscal conservatives, but many nationalists, which is the word that's being used by our president now, would object to. They don't want the United States. I mean, why should the United States go into neighborhoods and try to reduce murders there? There are murders here.
I mean, I understand that. I have very conservative relatives who say, this is my money. I'm going to spend it in America. I'm not going to spend it anywhere else. Okay, well, you can spend $100 million there, or you can spend billions here.
And some liberals object as well because they see it as, you know, meddling. But now you come...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But now you come to the other part of your plan that really angers some of your liberal readers, because you also point out that you believe very firmly in the rule of law. As somebody who lived in Argentina where it was mutilated, you also believe that if people don't come here the right way, what?
Well, I want to stipulate that compassion means you don't throw people who are seeking safety into these horrible prisons where we are putting them. We should release people with an ankle monitor, with a case manager. The truth is that 96% of asylum seekers show up to their court immigration hearing. Secondly, I think that these people need real due process in that courtroom. They are asking immigration judges to process 700 cases a year. That's impossible. So given those two stipulations, that we have to have a real due process in these courts, and I think especially for children who come here alone, give them a lawyer if they can't afford one. It is a sham to ask a toddler to stand before an immigration judge and expect that toddler, as we do now, to argue their immigration asylum case by themselves. That is a sham.
You're saying treat them fairly, give them a fair trial, but if they do not make it through a fair asylum process, the law is the law and they have to go home.
If you have a judicial process and you apply for asylum and you're allowed to go before that judge, if you lose that case, then you basically, you know, blend into the woodwork and become one of the 11 million people in this country here unlawfully. And I've lived in a country with no laws. You don't want that. I say be much more compassionate on the front end. Don't lock up 9 out of 10 of these asylum seekers as we are now doing. We were releasing 9 out of 10 5 years ago. Now we're locking up 9 out of 10. Give them a fair process in the courtroom. But if you do those two things, and that's a very big if, then I believe that you should direct the resources of ICE on the back end. Go and arrest people who have been denied asylum and deport them. Don't deport the family that's been here 20, 30 years, that has 4 U.S. citizen children, where you're going to, again, separate those kids from their parent. Deport someone who's been here 1 or 2 years and who has lost their asylum case. I don't have a problem doing that. And I don't think liberals can argue for the rule of law in Central America and not promote it within our own borders. Mm-hmm. I think that's hypocritical.
Sonia Nazario, so you have, it sounds like, heard from a lot of people.
Some.
Yeah.
Yes.
What else are people saying besides disagreeing with some part of your plan?
I mean, I think the real concern right now with the president's new executive order not allowing people to come between ports of entry and apply for asylum. First of all, our laws clearly stipulate that if you are on U.S. soil, you can apply for asylum. So I don't know how this can stand up legally. But what's going to happen until people challenge this legally is that you're going to force more and more people to come to these ports of entry and apply for asylum there. I know of a 43-year-old Mexican woman who showed up with the documents that her brother had been kidnapped. He had been cut to bits. They had left his bits on her patio. They turned her back 5 times without allowing her to apply for asylum. That's illegal. If you hang out for a month or weeks or days, the cartels are waiting for you right there to kidnap you and to torture you and to rape you and to demand ransom from your family members in the United States. We are putting people who have already been traumatized in further danger. We should not be doing that.
That's Sonia Nazario. Sonia, always thought-provoking to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Again, her book that she's best known for, Enrique's Journey, and we'll link you to her op-ed, her plan for migrants, at hearingnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And after every mass shooting, there's a call to harden targets like bars with armed guards. And this past weekend, Jamel Roberson, an armed black security guard at Manny's Blue Room Bar in Robbins, Illinois, did subdue a suspect after a shooting broke out. But police, responding to his call for help, shot him to death as he subdued the suspect. WBEZ reporter Miles Bryan is here. And Miles, this happened even though he was wearing a vest that said security, and witnesses in the bar were yelling at the police coming in that Jamel was actually a heroic security guard.
Yeah, you know, it was a bit chaotic. From what county investigators have said is that around 4 a.m. early Sunday morning, a shooting broke out in this bar. I've heard that a man basically left the bar and came back with a gun and started shooting. And Jamel Roberson was working security, and he starts to intervene. And I've heard from witnesses that Roberson was actually subduing one of the perpetrators. A number of folks got shot. It seemed a bit chaotic. Mm. And then the police arrive on scene from a couple of different municipalities, because these are all small suburbs. And one officer from a nearby suburb called Midlothian comes in and shoots Jamel Roberson and kills him, even as he's subduing one of the perpetrators, and even as witnesses say, they're saying he's security.
Look, what are officials from the police department saying?
You know, they've been pretty mum. The Cook County Sheriff, the local county sheriff, is investigating the club shooting, and the state police here in Illinois are investigating the officer shooting. But the police department where the officer is from that killed Roberson hasn't really been responding to any requests for comment. They're a very small department. And actually, I should tell you, WBEZ, our station, did a large project with a group called the Better Government Association looking at policing in the suburbs of Chicago. And there's just these huge systemic problems. I mean, these police are by and large underpaid. They're undertrained. They're not disciplined for police shootings. So this is part of a larger issue that we have, at least in this region.
Well, and it's part of another bigger picture. As we said, there's a call for, you know, the good guys with guns. And as Think Progress, as Lindsay Gibbs notes, this carries a risk for, you know, black people. He was an armed security guard and a good guy with a gun, risking his life to apprehend a shooter. And by the way, you know, worked in several churches, was a volunteer, wanted to be a police officer. This is quite a cautionary tale for, you know, black men becoming security guards.
Yeah, you know, it's just, it's really sad. I mean, he was, you know, by all accounts we've heard, a hero. I mean, he was in the process of saving lives during what could have been a terrible shooting. I mean, a couple of folks already got shot, but it could have been much worse.
Well, and that's been overshadowed. How are the people who were shot doing?
There's four other people who were shot. The Cook County Sheriff said they all have non-life-threatening injuries, and that's including the person who allegedly started the shooting. So we don't know much about that yet, but we're, you know, we're all following the case and trying to get some answers about who this officer was that that shot and killed Jamel Roberson.
But how is Jamel's family doing?
So they filed a federal lawsuit yesterday afternoon against the officer who shot and killed Jamel Roberson, who they've actually named as John Doe because they have not been able to figure out his name. And the village that he came from, the village of Midlothian. So they'll be suing. I talked to the lawyer for the Roberson family, Greg Kulis, and he says he's going to use the subpoena power to try and get some more answers.
Yeah. WBEZ's Miles Bryan in Chicago. Miles, thank you.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned, there are questions of race here, but others are saying this is a cautionary tale for anyone armed and attempting to take down a shooter, because when the police come, you're the one with the gun. Thoughts welcome here in now.org.
President Trump issued a major disaster declaration for the devastating fires still burning in Northern and Southern California. The declaration expedites federal aid to help those most affected. To talk about that aid now is Brandi Richard, a spokesperson with FEMA in Sacramento. Brandi, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First, this disaster declaration from the president came several days after the fires started. He's gotten some criticism for that. Does the timing of this declaration impact FEMA's ability to help provide help to people in need?
Absolutely not. We have been on the ground since the 8th when the fires actually started, supporting the state and local officials in ways that they requested to provide shelters and support for individuals who are there. We have not started the disaster recovery centers yet, so there is not yet a physical location where individuals can come and talk to us about their disaster recovery. Those will be forthcoming, and now that we have a major disaster declaration signed, those will be put in place.
You mentioned right now this immediate recovery is still in the hands of state and local government, but as the long-haul effort gets underway and FEMA gets more involved, are y'all going to set up temporary housing? Are there going to be trailers for these evacuees because there's so many people who are losing their homes or being forced from their homes?
You know, we've already started working on the temporary housing mission with the state. And so I can't give you specifics on which housing options they will use, but we're definitely having those conversations and we'll start to implement those programs.
There is no sign yet of these fires letting up. So when FEMA is dealing with these long-term events, how does the agency staff for them? How do you manage and prepare when the disaster is ongoing and there's no immediate sign of the fires ending?
You know, we have lots of reservists available to come to the disaster here. Some of them may cycle in and out, but we will have a presence here until the recovery mission is complete.
And how long do you expect that to be?
You know, it takes a while. I know that we were just finishing up the recovery mission that we did and for the wildfires last year a little bit earlier this year. So we expect to be here for the long haul. But that's why we do this work, and we're here to support our citizens.
Brandi Richard is a spokesperson with FEMA in Sacramento. Brandi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
To the island of Hawaii now and the 4,200-meter summit of Mauna Kea, a dormant volcano that is sacred land for indigenous Hawaiians. Astronomers say it's also among the best sites on the planet for stargazing. Last month, after years of protests and litigation, the Supreme Court of Hawaii sided with those astronomers. It approved a building permit for the 30-meter telescope, or TMT, to be built on Mauna Kea. The TMT will be the second largest telescope in the world, and it will let scientists peer into the early years of the universe, some 13 billion light years away. But some say that knowledge shouldn't come at the expense of Hawaiian spirituality. Today we'll hear from two young Kanaka Maoli, or indigenous Hawaiians, who fall on different sides of this controversy. First up is Makana Kushi, who opposes the construction of the observatory. Makana, what's sacred about Mauna Kea and its summit? What does the volcano mean to Native Hawaiians?
Mauna Kea is sacred to a lot of Hawaiians who still believe that our Akua, or gods, I think would be the closest English word to describe them, live there, not because they're sort of like humanoid beings that are standing on the mountain and living their lives every day, but that these ecosystems are manifestations of these spiritual beings.
So what does it mean then to put a telescope at the summit?
Putting a telescope at the summit to me is really disrespecting these Akua, because we see that as a space that belongs to them and not to humans. And also, and I think these two things are related, the ecosystem there is very gentle. There's a really specific climate on Mauna Kea that the bugs there, that the water there, that the plant life there requires. And with a lot of building, they won't survive.
We should mention that not all Native Hawaiians are opposed to the 30-meter telescope. Some say that star knowledge has always been really important to indigenous Hawaiians, and the construction of this observatory is a natural extension of that. What do you make of that argument?
So I've heard that argument a lot, and what I would have to say is that these astronomers, they like to connect what they are doing as Western scientists to ancient Polynesian voyaging. Our people use the stars to navigate and to find their way to Hawaii. And I think it's a very surface-level connection. Hmm. A lot of, you know, the knowledge that will come from the 30-meter telescope is not knowledge that will be trickled down to working-class Hawaiians. It's knowledge that will be in journal articles and help the careers of STEM PhDs.
This ruling by the Supreme Court of Hawaii doesn't mean that construction will start right away, but it does lift the biggest hurdle that the telescope collaboration faced. In the past, Native Hawaiians who oppose the project have gone as far as blocking construction vehicles from the mountain to prevent them from working on the telescope itself. Do you expect to keep fighting against the telescope, maybe in those sorts of ways?
I absolutely do. People have stated already that they're willing to get arrested again. They're willing to put their bodies between people who are seeking to construct TMT and the sacred space. And I support this 100%.
Makana Kushi is a Native Hawaiian from Hilo, Hawaii, who opposes the construction of the 30-meter telescope. Makana, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's hear now from Mailani Neal, who's studying to be a physicist and supports the construction of the 30-meter telescope. Mailani, you've loved astronomy since you were a kid, and now you're working towards an undergraduate degree in physics, and you say it's your dream to someday work in the telescope. What makes Mauna Kea such an ideal place for astronomical research?
Well, aside from my view that Hawaiians are born to navigate the unknown, there's also been scientific studies done on the situation surrounding Mauna Kea. Aspects like water vapor levels, atmospheric turbulence are just much more pristine than anywhere else in the world. Also, the fact that there's not much light pollution at all, that's starting to become a really big issue. They've actually had to designate dark sky reserves. So to have a place that is already in the perfect condition for astronomy is most ideal. Plus the fact that there have been telescopes already up there, so a lot of the infrastructure is there.
What can we learn by observing space through this new telescope as opposed to the other telescopes that have been
placed up there?
So the most obvious answer is the mirror size. With a bigger mirror, you can see further. And in astronomy, that's the name of the game. And we would also be able to see things with much more resolution. We would be able to see planets outside of our solar system.
Meanwhile, a lot of indigenous Hawaiians, one we just spoke to, oppose the construction of this telescope. They say the land is spiritually important and that building an observatory there would desecrate the land. What do you say to that?
I disagree that it is desecration. I've worked on the mountain for the past 2 summers, and all the staff that work at these observatories holds the mountain in such deep reverence. They love the mountain just as much. TMT itself would be a zero-waste facility. They've gone through the environmental impact. So that's all I can really say on that.
Let's talk a little bit more about perspective and framing, because as this controversy has gone on over the past 9 years, it's sometimes been framed as indigenous spirituality versus technology. But for you, being Kanaka Maoli and being a scientist are really intimately linked. What do you see as the problem with pitting Hawaiian spirituality in opposition to science?
Well, a big problem I see with that is not all Native Hawaiians are against the TMT. And on top of that, I think that the Hawaiians knew so much about the land, the animals, and about astronomy too, from observing. And that is the root of science.
Native Hawaiian Mailani Neal, who is studying to be a physicist and hopes to someday work on Mauna Kea. Mailani, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And a story now about the beauty industry and two notable trends. First, there's a growing focus on African-American women. Take Rihanna's Fenty Beauty line, tons of shades for different skin tones. It racked up a reported $100 million in sales in its first 40 days. But there's also a move to natural ingredients. Many hair and beauty products, especially those marketed to African-American women, still have potentially toxic ingredients. Julie Grant of the Allegheny Front spoke with some women who are trying to change that.
Malika Cooper was just a kid when she stopped using relaxer to straighten her hair and started wearing dreadlocks.
My grandfather was like, "Why are you putting those things in your hair? You need to go to the beauty parlor." I was like, "Granddad, no, my hair is done." He's like, "No, your hair is not done."
The relaxer had lye in it and could burn, but her family confronted her about not using it.
And they came up and they were like, "What are you doing? You're cutting your hair off. You're not putting any chemicals in it." You know, and they're like, "Why are you doing that?" I was like, "Because I don't want to put chemicals in my hair anymore."
Cooper has made a career of naturally styling hair at her salon in Baltimore and holding expos across the country, like this one in Cleveland. Standing on the small stage, Cooper laments that young black girls still use chemical relaxers to straighten their hair and are the only ones who have a kiddie perm marketed just to them.
We start at a young age telling our children that they're not beautiful in their own natural state. No other race has a kiddie perm for their children but us.
But times are changing. More people are becoming aware of chemicals and hair care products like parabens associated with hormonal problems and formaldehyde connected with cancer. Nika Laiba has been leading a survey of product ingredients at the Environmental Working Group. Some of the research focused on hair care products marketed to African-American women.
Less than 25% of the products we assessed scored in the green range, meaning low toxicity.
Laiba found that 75% of hair products for African-American women contain potentially toxic ingredients. That's compared with 60% of products for the entire population. Hair dyes and relaxers had the highest toxicity ratings.
It was disheartening.
The Environmental Working Group now has a searchable database of more than 73,000 specific products, and Laiba says it gets more than 1,000 searches an hour. She thinks that's why consumers are demanding change.
Hopefully by shining a light on what's available to specific demographics, companies will step up to the plate and offer more green-rated products.
Some major brands are responding. L'Oreal's Dark and Lovely line has long included a relaxer without lye, although the entire line is still considered a moderate health hazard by the Environmental Working Group. But when black girls don't use relaxers, some mothers still hear about it.
Is that your daughter? How come her hair isn't good like yours? And these are the things that are being passed on and continue to be passed on. It still happens.
That's lifestyle guru Madam Athena Chang. She says black women face lifelong discrimination for wearing their natural hair at work or at school, and some of it comes from other black women.
When the internalized racism is so deep that people don't have awareness, there are words that are thrown out still to this day.
But Chang says the move by many black women to wear natural hair is making a difference in the market. Research firm Mintel finds that sales of chemical relaxers plummeted by more than a third between 2012 and 2017, while sales of natural hairstyling products jumped 27% between 2013 and 2015. And this isn't small change. Mintel estimates annual sales of black hair care products at more than $2.5 billion. Chang says that should get companies' attention.
It is not okay that black women and women of color in general are sidelined and are an afterthought, because that has to change, especially the fact that we have so much buying power within this space.
Because you're still learning the fundamentals. Exactly. After the fundamentals, you're just going towards natural.
Exactly. Back at the Natural Hair Expo, Monica Green is talking with stylists considering training as natural hair specialists. Green runs a healthy hair academy as well as a salon on the west side of Cleveland called So Curly, So Kinky, So Straight. She says the wave toward natural hair really started around 5 years ago, but women still come to her salon with basic questions.
What can they do with their hair? I want to do a big chop. I want to take all this chemical out of my hair. I want to start with my hair. I just want to wear my hair. And what can I do?
Green says she simply tells them that natural hair can be fun and beautiful. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant in Pittsburgh.
And back to our top story today, the news from Northern and Southern California, where wildfires have now killed more than 40 people in the state, about 40 in the north alone, and more than 200 are unaccounted for in Butte County in the north. There are stories of family members going from shelter to find loved ones. So this afternoon on All Things Considered, they'll pick up the reporting and bring us the latest from the fire zone and the effort to find those who are missing. That's later today on ATC. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Elise Hugh. This is Here and Now.